This is an ABC podcast. This is the WA Country Hour with Belinda Varischetti on ABC Radio WA.
Hello there and a very good afternoon to you. Today, a WA egg producer says it's a real cause for concern that the deadly bird flu strain H5N1 may be infecting wildlife on Australia's Heard Island, which really isn't that far off the coast, the south coast of Western Australia. Also, the CEO of a global alliance representing the coal industry says the tone of the conversation around coal in Australia really needs to change, as it is going to underpin base load power in this country for many years to come. We'll get into that conversation after the news headlines at 12:30 today. 12:06 here on the ABC, right across Western Australia, streaming live on the web and on the ABC Listen app. First up today, premium wine producers say the export door to China may be open again, but it's proving to be very challenging to get a real foothold in this market that's so important to the Australian wine industry. Australian wine exports to China resumed in March last year after the Chinese government abolished heavy tariffs it imposed on the sector back in 2020. But the market has changed. Cost of living pressures, health concerns, a reported crackdown on lavish banquets for civil servants, and tariff wars are all affecting the global wine trade. Penfolds owner Treasury Wine Estates recently announced it would sell less of the luxury label in China than it had previously been forecasting. Executive Director of the Wine Economics Research Centre, Professor Kim Anderson, says Penfolds' decision is no surprise.
I think it's true in lots of countries, not just China, that the uncertainty that Trump has introduced into global markets generally has reduced people's confidence in both spending and investing. And in China, that's certainly the case. And there it's been complicated by not even yet being able to reach a tariff agreement with the US and simultaneously having this housing crisis yet to be resolved. It's really the general economic environment is just not good. And COVID, of course, made things really hard in China when they were locked down for so long. Consumers couldn't get out to restaurants, and that's where they normally would consume wine. So that caused a blip there as well.
Up until now, would it be fair to say that it has been those sort of more bulk-produced wines that have really felt the effects? Has there been much of an impact on the premium market up until this point?
I think there has. It's across the board, because rich people also get hit when these times are less certain, so they're probably reducing as well. But in addition, during that period of COVID, there was still a flood of imports. People were expecting consumption to keep growing rapidly, and it didn't. And so there were big stocks of wine, including premium wines, that were just sitting there and were needing to be cleared once the market opened up again, once the COVID disappeared and the market got going again. And so that's dampened growth in imports in recent times as well.
Professor Kim Anderson, Executive Director of the Wine Economics Research Centre, speaking to Selena Green. 12:09. Rich Birch is the Sales and Marketing Director at Howard Park, a Margaret River-based winery that's been exporting to China for around about 25 years. He agrees the Chinese market has its challenges, but that just means there's work to be done, especially around relationships.
China and Asia in particular, more than probably any other market, is very much about relationships. And with the market being closed for the 3 years, we're really trying to rebuild those relationships again. And in many cases, a lot of the businesses involved in the wine supply chain are being rebuilt. That just sort of strengthens the need for the wine category to have a bit more innovation, just like any other market in the world, just as Australia needs. And it's certainly been slower than we would have hoped to have been. What's driving the decline? I think there's a few things driving that. I mean, recently you may have seen there's a Chinese government booze ban for government officials. That's certainly hurting Australian wine exports, and that's slowing sales. yes, there are challenges. The Chinese economy is probably weakened and a bit soft at the moment, and certainly the level of disposable income that people have, which would typically go towards wine, is just not there that it was. I don't think the global volatility in the political environment, more so, I don't want to say trade war, but certainly just volatility in a global economy, that sort of stuff doesn't help either. The Chinese wine market remains a really important market for Australian wine, particularly for Western Australia at all price points. So yes, there are challenges. Yes, it's slowed things down more than we would like it to be. But yes, there are also green shoots, and it remains the number one wine market for Dubbo wine. So we're going to keep going at it. It just strengthens the need to keep pounding the pavement, promoting our wines, and hope that it'll turn around in the future.
Since things opened back up in March this year, Rich, how much have you guys been shipping to China, and what sort of varieties are the main ones that they're looking for?
Like everyone else, we shipped a minimum of one container of premium wine at various price points, all very, very ultra premium price points. And it was probably a little bit more red dominant, so Cabernet, Shiraz. But the surprising trend that we've noticed in the last probably 6 months is the popularity of white wine has really been a pleasant surprise, and that's around Chardonnay, Sauv Blanc, Semillon, and Riesling have been really popular, and to a lesser extent, sparkling wine, which is something that we specialise in also.
As you say, China is the number one export market for Australia. With things taking a little bit of a turn recently, you know, demand dwindling a bit, are there any other export markets that you would be looking to or think other wine producers should be considering in Australia?
Absolutely. I mean, China's, as I mentioned, number one, but by secondary markets would certainly be the UK, which remains a really important market for Australian wine. I would also say Canada and the USA in the Americas, they remain really important, particularly with some of the volatility there. There's been a few more opportunities that have popped up with some of the tariff wars happening over there that have moved products off shelves and created some opportunity for Australian wine, particularly in Canada and Asia as a whole. I mean, obviously a very big place, but particularly Southeast Asia. In certain pockets, there's really great growth with the right partner. I do think there are lots of opportunities there, and I think we just need to keep at it and keep working at it.
What do you think needs to happen to get back to the pre-COVID days?
Oh, I think we need to keep pounding the pavement first and foremost. We do need stability in the market. Australian wine is not going to sell itself. When we spent 3 years out of the market, there are other countries that had continued access to the Chinese market, and they've filled that gap that was previously there, filled by Australia. So essentially, we need to try and convince the trade channels, the consumers, the distributors, and all people in the wine business supply chain that we deserve a spot back in that market. And I think Australian wine does have a very good style, particularly Western Australia's fresher, lighter styles of wines at various different price points. That's very appealing. And I think stylistically, the wine coming out of WA is suitable towards where the market's trending globally, not just China. So that's certainly going to help our cause. But it's not going to solve itself overnight. I think it's going to be a slow, gradual thing, and it will need time and investment. So there's no silver bullet, no easy fix. It's going to take hard work and plenty of effort. We need a bit of luck to fall our way as well, and sort of global stability to start occurring as well. And it'd be nice for the Chinese economy to sort of strengthen as well. That would certainly help our cause.
What's next for you guys at Howard Park in terms of rebuilding that market?
We're going to keep going to the market, keep visiting our partners. We know that our wines are well received in China. It's just finding those people and re-educating the customers about the joys and the benefits and the pleasure that our wines bring.
Howard Park Sales and Marketing Director Rich Birch. 14 past 12. Wines of WA CEO Larry Jorgensen says 25 wine producers from the south will head to Shanghai next month to showcase what WA has to offer.
Everybody on that group seems quite positive about the opportunities. It's 25 producers going, so you know they are putting their money on the table to have a look. And I think people are probably going to have a look and just confirm what the situation is. But those trends, lighter, fresher styles, a move to white wine, and an establishment of understood trade channels, which maybe weren't as well understood previously. So retail seems to be coming more understandable and perhaps following some of the traditional frameworks that we have in other markets with good distributors and retailers, and then some large retailers really supporting wine. And then, interestingly, I think direct-to-consumer and online offers some opportunities that are very different in China to anywhere else. And they've really embraced, I think, online retailing and how that's facilitated through social media platforms and means of paying. So there's that. And I think the final thing is, I think it seems that younger Chinese consumers are becoming more confident in what they want to drink. They're not looking simply for brands to show that they understand wine or that they're knowledgeable at wine. They're really looking, becoming adventurous and seeking out things that might not be, you know, a Penfolds, which is perhaps a luxury brand. They're looking for things that excite them, and they're looking to become more educated about wine and what really, I guess, makes a wine premium. So there's a lot to unpack there, and you know, here we're very positive about what that might represent.
Mm. What, is there a particular reason why now we've got those WA producers heading over to Shanghai?
Yeah, look, I guess it's timing in one sense. You can't change some of the dynamics in China, and you know, we know that kind of like Christmas here, Chinese New Year, which occurs sort of late January, February, is a key period for sales. And whilst it's pretty close up to that particular period, the opportunity to go there and to speak to distributors and retailers about opportunities to be a part of that sales period is pretty good. It also aligns with a trade show that's more broad. I think it's a general sort of agricultural trade show that Department of Primary Industries is supporting WA producers of all sorts to attend in Shanghai at the front end of that N11 period. And then following that is ProVine Shanghai, which is an international trade show that a lot of the producers will stay on and attend. And it just means, I guess, that there's an opportunity to engage with the trade and distributors will be in town, if you can call Shanghai a town, for those events. I mean, off-site, away from those events as well. So it just is a good opportunity to take advantage of that.
And what are the main sort of questions you would be expecting producers going over to Shanghai would have, or what answers would they be searching for in terms of exporting their products to China?
Pretty much the same as they would in any market, really. What styles of wine look to be in demand? Where's that trend going? What are the price points that are considered? And what sort of distribution is available? So those are the three main points that people will be looking to find answers to.
Wines of WA CEO Larry Jorgensen talking about the WA Fine Wine Showcase in Shanghai in November. And he was speaking to Amelia Searson. 18:12.
My name's Ross Aridi. I'm at Kelly Station. I make sure that I listen to the Country Hour every day and listen to Belinda Barischetti.
That's great to hear, Ross. Thank you. 12:18. A WA egg producer says it's a real cause for concern that the deadly bird flu strain H5N1 may be infecting wildlife on Australia's Heard Island, about 4,000 kilometres from the south of the state. Scientists who recently travelled to the island in the Southern Ocean noticed unusually high mortality among elephant seals, which they fear is the H5N1 strain. Samples have now been taken from the seals and will be tested when those scientists return to the mainland. Albany Farm Fresh Eggs owner Colin Ford believes it's now a matter of time before the deadly strain arrives here in Australia.
Yeah, it's obviously quite shocking that it's getting nearer to Australia. Australia is the only continent that hasn't got this strain of bird flu at the moment. So to hear that it's getting closer is certainly a cause for concern.
Yeah, and obviously news of this H5 strain of bird flu hasn't come out of the blue. And as you mentioned, Australia's been lucky enough to be the only continent free of this particular strain. But Understandably, you would have been putting measures, I would suspect, to keep your flocks safe. Colin, what would some of those measures be?
Yeah, of course, inevitably, and probably sadly, it will end up getting to Australia at some point. As much as you try and keep it out, when it's carried in with migratory birds, there's only so much you can do. So then it just comes down to a farm level of trying to minimise that risk. So we've got two sites that we produce eggs at. So we don't transfer any equipment or people between the two laying flocks. So if one did come down with it, it doesn't affect the other one. And then it's just, you know, we have got the ability, if we need to be able to keep the birds inside to reduce the exposure. And then also we try to minimise contact that our birds do have with wild birds. So all the feeders and drinkers for the birds are inside the shed, so you're not trying to attract wildlife into the area that the hens roam on. And obviously there's an increased risk with free range being able to contract the bird flu, but that's not to say that it's a zero risk with intensive poultry. And then obviously we've gone more down the free range route. We've spent a lot of money to do that and expand the business. So yeah, it's obviously a risk, as in any agriculture primary production, you're at the risk of a lot of things, whether it's weather related, disease or government really. So you're just trying to minimize that risk all the time.
Southern WA is the closest part of Australia to Heard Island, where scientists suspect that the H5 strain of bird flu has been found. Granted, Heard Island is still thousands of kilometres away from mainland Australia, but what would an outbreak of this virus mean for you, your business and for other businesses in Australia?
Oh, look, well, it's 4,000 kilometres away, but you know, there's migratory routes from north of Australia and south of Australia where there's bird flu. So, you know, it can come in from anywhere. You're just exposed as a primary production. You know, it's getting more and more expensive to produce a product, whether it's staffing, inputs, machinery, whatever, and the margins are getting tighter all the time. So you only need an outbreak of disease that can wipe out your business, and it can take years to recover. You know, you're working on such small margins all the time. So yeah, it would, you know, and there's the emotional impact as well. If you were to get taken out with bird flu, obviously the staff are heavily involved in that. And then as a producer of eggs, we've built a lot of relationships over the years with our customers who recognise what we're trying to do with our business and the quality of the product that we produce. So, you know, you're trying to build up those relationships, and then it can just be gone overnight.
Well, fingers crossed we can hold it off for as long as possible, Colin, that's for sure. So what happens next? Are you going to be ramping up any protective measures, or what are you looking at now?
Oh, look, we can't do any more than we do already. Biosecurity is high on our list of priorities anyway. It's going to be the middle of November before it's either confirmed or not as being bird flu that's on Heard Island. So it's just wait and see. And, yeah, just keep a focus on what we're doing, trying to produce eggs as best as we can.
Albany Farm Fresh eggs owner Colin Ford speaking to Amelia Searson. 23 past 12 here on the Country Hour. Shortly, an update from the newsroom for you. Then we'll head off to the Bureau of Meteorology, check the conditions right across the state. And then just before 1, heading to Mouchet for the results of the cattle market. First, though, just before the news headlines, farmers across east and southeastern Australia are being asked to take part in a citizen science project to better understand and protect one of our most unique animals, the platypus. Now, unfortunately, these shy egg-laying mammals aren't found here in Western Australia, so you can't take part in this project. But if you've ever seen one, you'll know just how joyful it is to spot a platypus in the wild. And I have had that experience when I lived in Tasmania back in the day, and it is a real joy to see that right before your eyes. This project is a joint initiative by the Australian Conservation Fund and the University of New South Wales. And to find out more about it, Fiona Breen visited a platypus hotspot on a farm in southern Tasmania.
Matt Tack, who farms with Corrine Ung at the foothills of the Harz Mountains in Tasmania's far south, says spotting platypus is part of daily life.
On any sort of given day, when it's calm enough, when it's not windy like it is today, we can go out there and we can see, you know, one, two, sometimes three platypuses on the dam, which is just incredible. And you kind of judge what kind of day you're going to have, whether it's a one platypus day or a three platypus day, right? So it always makes us smile when we go out there and we can see them.
Their property, Our Mates Farm, is a launch pad for the Platy Project, a national effort to try to get a handle on the numbers of platypus in waterways across Australia. Their irrigation dam hosts a family of very content platypus.
Well, I've been, you know, from within a couple of metres of a platypus sitting on one of the logs on the far side of the dam, just giving itself a really good scratch, you know, and happily sit there, and it'll happily sit there, and I'll just sit there and I'll film it on the phone, and it'll happily sit there for 10 or 15 minutes. And then, like this morning when I was out there trying to film it, I was sneaking around the edge of the dam and he'd pop up and see me and he'd go straight down again, right? So,
according to Jess Abrahams, platypus expert at the Australian Conservation Foundation, Our Mates Farm is a model for nature-friendly farming, with native grasses on the banks of their dam and organic farming a perfect fit.
Because you're obviously doing something right. You're farming in a way that's nature-friendly. And, you know, we know that we can protect platypus in national parks, but we can't have national parks everywhere, as much as we might like to. We still need to grow all the food that we need. And so landowners and farmers have a critical role to play maintaining healthy ecosystems and biodiversity. Farmers manage more than 50% of the Australian landmass, so they've got a unique role to play making sure we have healthy waterways, because what we do on the land obviously affects what we do in the water.
But across Australia, our platypus populations are struggling. A 2020 study led by the University of New South Wales found their habitat had shrunk by at least 22% over 30 years. And efforts to have the platypus listed as a threatened species have so far failed.
We nominated the platypus as a threatened species nationally nearly 5 years ago now, and the scientific community came back to us and said, listen, there's just not enough data to determine either way whether or not platypus meet the threshold. And I think it was like a 15% in population, 20% population decline over three generations. And so our application basically was rejected. So Platy Project was born in partnership with the University of New South Wales to collect the missing data needed to determine whether or not platypus are a threatened species.
That's where the Platy Project comes in.
We would love everyday Australians who live on the east coast, anywhere from Queensland to Tasmania, as far west as Adelaide, to visit a local creek or waterway. Dawn or dusk is the best time. Sit quietly by the riverbank and observe. Look for signs of platypus. That might be a V-shaped bow wave is the most telling sign.
Participants are asked to log sightings or the absence of them on the interactive Platy Project map. Every data point helps researchers build a clearer picture of platypus distribution and strengthen the case for their protection.
At the end of the five-year period, we are going to crunch the data, make an assessment whether or not we think they are threatened, whether they meet the threshold of decline, and we'll resubmit platypus as a threatened species to the government.
In the meantime, these farmers on this little property in Tasmania's deep south enjoy sharing their land and waterways with a healthy family of platypus.
We love having them here. We do everything here with one eye on the wildlife and nature. Biodiversity is super important to what we do. We think there's a strength in that and a resilience that comes with having that. And the platypus for us is kind of almost like an indicator for us. We look at that and go, oh, must be doing something right.
Farmer Matt Tack, ending that report from Fiona Breen. And Tony Carl's just walked into the studio. He's got the news headlines in just a moment. But Matt was talking about that survey, the Platy Project, trying to just get a handle on the number of platypus across Australia and really getting people to get involved from, say, Queensland, right down the east coast and as far west as Adelaide. 29 past 12, Tony Carr, as I mentioned, in the studio. What's making the headlines, Tony?
Good afternoon, Belinda. The WA government has defended the state's slowing financial growth following a report into Australia's economic performance. The ComSec Quarterly State of the States says WA is the country's strongest economy, leading in household spending and housing finance. But WA recorded one of the weakest growth figures, with economic activity 3.62% above the long-term average. The Federal Aged Care Minister says the government's new Aged Care Act is a significant step for the rights of older Australians. The new laws, designed to improve the quality and safety of aged care, come into effect on Saturday. Sam Ray says under the new co-payment arrangements, entrants into the system will be encouraged to contribute to their care. And the Prime Minister has told China's second most powerful leader that Australia wants a stable and constructive relationship with Beijing. Anthony Albanese has sat down with China's Premier Li Qiang on the sidelines of the ASEAN meeting in Malaysia's capital, Kuala Lumpur. Premier Li says there's a strong upward momentum in the relationship, and Mr. Albanese says he's glad to see more Australian ministers are visiting China. Belinda, more news at 1 o'clock.
Thank you for that update, Tony. Appreciate that. 29 to 1 here on the Country Hour. Heading to Mushay just before 1 for the results of the cattle market today. And we'll also look at the future of potash production here in Western Australia. One analyst thinks it really could be over at this point, despite that really strong global demand for potassium fertiliser. And also, the CEO of a group called Future Coal thinks the tone of the conversation around coal here in Australia really needs to change, because coal is here to stay for many years to come, and we need to sort of start embracing diversity if you really want a secure and affordable energy system going forward. We'll get her thoughts shortly. And in just a moment, we'll head off to the Bureau of Meteorology. Here on the Country on the ABC, right across Western Australia. Let's make our way to the Bureau of Meteorology now. Luke Huntington is with you this afternoon. Luke, take us for a look around the Southwest Land Division.
Yeah, hi, Belinda. So there's not too much going on today. We do have a high south of the state and a trough developing off the west coast, so it's keeping conditions pretty clear over the Southwest Land Division today. We did have a just chance of a light shower over the southeast coastal districts, probably just east of Esperance there, but most of that's sort of cleared now, and there's not really too much else going on. But we do have a trough that deepening down the west coast tomorrow. So quite windy conditions in the northeasterly in the morning, and then the trough will move inland from early afternoon, and still quite gusty with that trough going inland. So there'll be a west to northwesterly change coming through with that for the western parts. And another feature of tomorrow is the warming temperatures. So temperatures are going to be quite hot through the wheat belt and into the inland central west. We're going for temperatures on the order of 35 to 36 through many places, like Mullawa, Morawa, up there at Delwollinu, getting up, Southern Cross 33, so Northern 35, so quite hot through that area tomorrow. And even in the lower west, we're getting into the low 30s, and into the Great Southern also into the low 30s, such as Katanning, going with 31 down there. But we're not expecting any weather with that trough moving through. It's really just those gusty winds and the warm to hot temperatures. There will be some elevated fire dangers associated with those winds and temperatures, but we're not expecting expecting any extreme values for any of the fire districts. After that goes through, there is a bit of a change on Wednesday, so we do have a weak cold front moving through. The rainfall will start from the early morning about the southwest capes and move inland during the morning and afternoon. So probably during the morning period, the showers will probably be just southwest of a line from Geraldton to Bremer Bay, then extending to Kelberry to Ravensthorpe in the afternoon. But much of the shower activity will be about the lower west and southwest districts. We've got about 1 to 3 millimetres covering that area on Wednesday. But once you get to the southwest wheat belt into the western Great Southern, you're probably only looking at less than a millimetre. And then heading into Thursday, there is another weak cold front brushing the southwest corner. So it'll maintain showers over southwest to parts of the southwest land division. So we're talking about southwest of around about Lancelin, across to Katanning to Bremer Bay, anywhere between that line, anywhere southwest of that line should get about 1 to 3 millimetres or so. And then, there's a further cold front coming through later Friday. So some showers in the prefrontal northwesterly flow, and then the actual cold front probably coming through in the evening period, later in the evening. And we could see 5 to 10 millimetres between Bunbury and Walpole before midnight, 1 to 5 once you get to Perth, to Albany, and then probably less than a millimetre once you get to Durian Bay, across to Bremer Bay. And then Saturday is looking pretty showery through the southwest land division, so maybe a couple more millimetres through Saturday.
And what's the story across northern and eastern parts of the state then, Luke?
Yeah, we've got some showers and thunderstorms forecast for northern and eastern parts of the Kimberley this afternoon. So just your typical seasonal thunderstorms up there. It's been pretty windy through the sort of the northern interior this morning, but the winds are dropping off at the moment. Heading into tomorrow, we do see a continuation of those thunderstorms through the northern eastern parts of the Kimberley. So Kununurra, Columbaroo, Argyle, those places, but Broome, Fitzroy Crossing should be out of that thunderstorm area. As we head into Thursday, a very, very similar situation over the northern and eastern parts of the Kimberley. So places, like, as I mentioned just then, in a similar area. And on Friday, very similar as well. The thunderstorms will probably expand through most of the Kimberley. So Fitzroy Crossing is included. Broome's just out of it with the sea breeze keeping it inland. And the thunderstorms may be getting into the eastern parts of the north interior.
Luke, thank you for going through those details for us this afternoon. Appreciate that. 23-1 here on the Country Hour. On Monday, we take a look back at the rainfall over the weekend, so the last 72 hours to 9 o'clock this morning, and checking 5 millimetres and over. We'll start in northern and eastern forecast districts. In the Kimberley, Billaluna had 12, Nicholson 6, the interior, Warburton Airfield 8, and then Eucla had 36, and Forrest had 5. Moving into the southwest land division, the lower west, Anketell 9, Bickley 8, Bungendore 17, Dwelling Up 16, Gleneagle 12, Jandakot Arrow 11, Jarrahdale had between 14 and 15, Carnot 20, Carrigullen North 12, Mandurah 7, Mount Solis 11, Mushay 6, Mundaring 6, and the Perth metro area 6 in the gauge also. Pinjarra had between 16 and 18, Rolleystone 11, Serpentine 14, Wanneroo 6, Waroona 6, and Woodridge Estate had 5. In the southwest, Acton Park 6, Ballingup 7, Beetleup 11, Boyan up north 6, Bridgetown 7, Brunswick Junction 15. Bunbury 5, Busselton between 9 and 12, Cape Lewin 7, Cape Naturalist 6, Capel 9 to 12, Carlotta 10, Chapman Hill 4 to 7, Collie East 6, Kawarumup 8, Dardanup had between 7 and 14, Donnybrook 5, Doyle Road 6, Ferguson Valley between 9 and 10 mils, Four Acres 10, Happy Valley Alert 20. Harvey 13, Hentybrook 14, Jarrahwood 9, Carradale 11, Logbrook 19, Ludlow 13, Manjimup 8 to 10, Margaret River 8, Mayenup South 6, Millionup 11, Mount William 13, Mile Up 14, Nanup 11, Northcliff 11, Paindale Alert 9, Pemberton 16, Perivale Orchard 11, Quinanup 22, Ravenscliff Alert 13, Rosabrook 8, Scott River 5, Shannon 8, Tonebridge 8, Vass 7, Windy Harbour 7, Worsley Downs 7, Yanmar had 10 and Yungurulup 7. Southern Coastal Region, Albany between 6 and 9, Denbarker 6, Denmark 9, Kimberley 8, King River 9, Tamar 6. And finishing up in the Great Southern, Boddington North 5, Quartering 5, Cranham 5, Culford 6, Franklin between 5 and 8, Maradong 8 and Quailup 6 in the gauge. 20 minutes to one. An independent analyst says the future of potash production in Western Australia could be over, despite strong global demand for potassium fertiliser. Now, this follows a decision by WA-based minerals company Agrimin to withdraw its plan to harvest salt from Lake Mackay in the Pilbara near the NTWA border. It was going to be one of the state's largest potash projects. But Agrimin says a strategic review found the development to be uneconomic, so it's not happening. Industry analyst Peter Strachan says it's not a surprise, but it is disappointing given just how much fertiliser Australia imports.
It's not unexpected. 5-6 years ago, we had a number of companies looking to develop salts for potash. That's the sulphate of potash, which is used as a fertiliser. And it was all looking fairly promising. The price of sulphate of potash was rising, and the feasibility studies looked fairly positive. And then we had a number of projects actually start up and really fail technically to achieve the results that they thought they would be able to get. So moving from the sort of laboratory or the benchtop scale to full-scale production was more challenging than these people had actually estimated. And then during the at the beginning of the Russia's invasion of the Ukraine, the price of fertilizers generally really shot up dramatically, and sulfate of potash prices went up over $1,000 a ton from about $200 a ton. But since 2022, the price has really fallen right back. In the meantime, Agrimin has suffered rising capital costs, and of course, the ability of people to finance this, to provide equity and or debt, has really diminished because they've seen the prices for the product falling, and they've seen obviously capital costs rising, but more importantly, they've seen a number of projects actually fall over, and they're going, well, why would we want to support a project like that, which has got so much technical and also market risk.
So why do you think those earlier potash projects failed in the beginning? What were the main reasons for that?
Well, I think the technology didn't work. These are complex salts. You have to isolate the potash from the sodium chloride and any other salts that are in the player, the salt player, and they thought that they could do that efficiently, and they weren't able to produce a product of sufficient quality in the quantities that were required to really cover their operating costs of the project. So it was really, I think they were just hyped up by the idea, and they thought that the price would just continue to run, and you know, they were beaten, you know, by the market effectively.
So do you think this is a sign that potash production in WA is dead in the water?
For the moment, it is. I would like to see some of these projects get up because Australia is a net importer of these products, both all sorts of, whether it's urea for potassium-based fertilisers or for phosphate-based fertilisers. We import most of the products that we use, and it would be really good from a logistical point of view and from a security of supply point of view if we could get domestic production to stand up.
What do you think would need to happen in order to make that come to fruition though?
Well, we'd have to see a little bit more science involved in how to treat these salt players so that they don't run into the same sort of technical problems. And, you know, maybe someone will come up with a cleverer way of basically refining the salt to get the pure concentrate of potassium sulfate that the market wanted. I mean, there's the Pivot project in Queensland, which is really Incitec Pivot has basically sold out of its fertilizer business to Ridley, but Ridley's only going to take on the supply side, the distribution side, and they'll be importing product and distributing it through their distribution channels. They're not going to take on the role of mining, as I think that project is basically running out of resources in northern Queensland. So, you know, I think we'd need a bit more exploration and a bit more targeting of likely candidates to be useful products. I mean, there are byproducts. You could also, in some of these players have lithium in the salts as well, and there's also aluminium that could be refined. So maybe if they had a multi product, you know, producing high quality refined alumina and lithium salts as well as potassium salts, that would be a way of having a three-pronged approach.
Corporate analyst Peter Strachan speaking to Georgia Hargreaves. 12:45 here on the Country Hour. The CEO of a global alliance representing the coal industry says the tone of the conversation around coal here in Australia needs to change, as it really is going to be underpinning baseload power in this country for many years to come. Michelle Manouk is the CEO of Future Coal. This is a think tank of forward-focused coal participants across the coal value chain, driven to ensure that coal prospers sustainably from producer to the end user. She says diversity is the key to a secure and affordable energy system.
There's certainly been an enormous amount of anti-coal sentiment around the world, that's for sure. I would say that's been really perpetuated by the global north. But in the emerging developing markets, that's really not the story. The story is, how do we harness the potential? How do we get most value out of this product? They see coal as a multi-commodity product. And the transition is really where coal will be part of a diverse mix. It's not really there to be excluded. It's certainly still a form in coal power of cheap, reliable, you know, affordable and secure energy. And for them, it's been more about, well, how do we actually make that better? How do we do that better? Because there are known technologies today which can abate, particularly in coal power, up to 99% of coal pollutants. So in Asia in particular, where you see a lot of the coal fleets, they're running some of the most efficient fleets in the world. So it's not a transition away, but it is about looking at something that's quite important and probably misses in a bit of the Australian debate, which is about baseload power. So coal still provides that reliability, which is quite important. And the diversity is important as well. So we're not, you know, certainly from our perspective, a lot of our members are in renewables as well. This is not about saying, you know, let's choose one over the other. Again, in those emerging developing markets, it's how do we create the most reliable energy system and the most diverse energy system that's secure with a focus on the baseload. And if coal is the one, because it's secure, it's affordable, and it's going to be safe, and they can apply the best technology to it, then they pick it. So, yeah, I think, unfortunately, we've been talking about a transition away as opposed to a transition towards, you know, what makes sense is a diverse energy system for any nation around the world.
But what technology would enable you to clean up 99% of the emissions? Because yes, we certainly haven't seen it. I mean, we've talked about carbon storage, but that hasn't really worked yet.
Yeah, look, that's certainly one carbon capture and storage. But what we're seeing around the world is just ahead of that. You put in high efficiency, low emissions technology. There's a lot of pollutant controls already for, you know, the SOx, NOx and particulates. These things all exist. So some of the anti-coal sentiment is really about old technology. That's not how the new modern plants are being built. And in terms of carbon capture and storage, I think it's had a really unfair run. In China, again, we're seeing coal plants and with CCS that are actually capturing up to 1.5 million tonnes of CO2 a year. So it can be done. It can be done at a really good economic economic rate. And I think it's quite important that we correct the record and understand that these opportunities exist. A lot of the Australian coal plants are old. They do need to be upgraded. Retrofits can happen. And it's really a question of doing the numbers and working it out.
We're not seeing too many companies doing that, though, are we? In fact, they're drawing forward the closure date.
Yeah, and I think that's it's not been a conversation. The conversations that we're having, you've just seen this in the US now, where the current administration has actually put in $650 million to upgrade their power plants, with a recognition that, look, our power plants are old, but we need them. And I think, that's an interesting conversation, probably one that Australia wants to have. There's still an enormous amount of reliance on coal power here in Australia, and so what does it mean to, and where do we rate security of our supply and affordability of supply, therefore prioritising the upgrade of some of those plants? And let's be really honest, some of those plants, it's just not commercial to upgrade them. But that doesn't mean that it's not commercial for all those plants to be upgraded, or even to dismiss a new coal power fire station. Like, I don't think we do that. I think we have to ask the right questions about what's going to create that affordable, reliable supply, and can it be, can best technology be put to it to really work on those pollutants? The answers are yes, and that's really what we're seeing in Asia and their direction of flow. And now with that signal from the US, I think that's a much more positive conversation that we're looking at.
Are you talking to the federal government about a package to upgrade coal facilities, build a new power station?
Yeah, look, we're going to put everything on the agenda this this year for the conversation. And in fact, there's something that we've particularly looked at, which is called sustainable coal stewardship. And it's just a really simple map that really demonstrates how the coal industry is modernising across, in pre-combustion, combustion and beyond combustion, and the technologies and the innovation that actually exists. And this is really, Queensland, New South Wales and federal government. Is that coal is really seen as an ecosystem in the two largest coal-based economies, that being China and India. They see coal as a multi-commodity product because it is. It has many tentacles. It's either a direct or an indirect import into many industries. And it's quite important to have that sophisticated point of view. So even for coal and coal waste, you can extract high-value products like critical minerals and rare earths. Those sorts of sectors are actually being explored, even by places like the US. So I think it's quite important that we understand and we know that coal has a contribution to make, in the beyond combustion sector and really can address some of those issues around security. And some of those other nations are getting ahead on that. And I think for Australia, it's a real opportunity given our resources here in terms of coal and our reserves.
We have a lot of people screaming about the cost of power in Australia, which is kind of nuts because we have so much coal. Is there any relief in sight? If you look at foreign markets, the price of coal, broadly speaking, will prices ever come down again?
Look, unfortunately, I don't have a mandate to, nor a crystal ball, really, to speak on that. We're seeing rising prices. The UK alone, who was the earliest, we saw the earliest retirement of coal. We've had the CEOs of the major retail power organisations come out and say that bills are going to go up yet another £100 if we continue on this trajectory of 100% renewables. So I think the conversation just really has to shift to affordability. And affordability is really about looking at what is going to be secure in terms of a baseload, what really supports the system of electricity to provide that dispatchable power. And then you should be getting to something that's much more affordable.
But the other side of that equation is emissions. So are emissions going down globally from coal?
Well, we know that emissions aren't going down globally, full stop. But what we know is that we have technology that allows emissions to go down for coal power and, other coal industrial sectors like steel. And so it's really about having the funding that's not exclusionary, the funding that allows coal to participate and invest in those in those abatement opportunities. Right now, it's actually, except in Asia and Southeast Asia and other places, it's quite difficult for a coal operation to really put up that business case because of many exclusionary policies that exist. Investors need confidence, that's an absolute reality, but equally investors have to look at their policies. I'm speaking with a lot of the finance and investment sector about exclusionary policies that have actually not pushed forward the opportunities for coal. And again, you know, David, let's just be really honest. This is not about saying rah-rah coal. This is about saying what is right for Australia. And whatever that is, if it's coal, then I think people just need to understand that it can be abated in a way in which is consistent with the kinds of opportunities and environmental goals that we're seeking. But it has to be allowed to be part of the conversation.
Michelle Manouk, CEO of global lobby group Future Coal, speaking to David Claughton. On the text, Julian Denmark says, a person personally, don't know why you would give the coal industry airtime. Let China and India burn as much coal as we can send them. Renewables are going to save Australia's climate. The text 0448 922 604. Well, more than 5,000 Australian dairy cattle have been exported to Indonesia in the last 12 months to keep up with the growing demand for fresh milk. The Indonesian government earlier this year launched a $45 billion program to provide free meals to children, pregnant women and toddlers within their population of 286 million people. Dr. Rita Aksar from the Centre of Global Food and Resources at the University of Adelaide has just got back from a trip to Indonesia to investigate what the program means for Australia and the future of the Indonesian dairy industry.
Maybe in terms of the dairy herd, currently the dairy cattle herd is around 500,000. And then the majority of this fresh milk is produced by, we call it a smallholder farmers that manage 2 to 3 dairy cattle per farm. So it's quite small. But then also there's another like growing number of mega farms. We call it mega farms because they manage more than 2,000 dairy cattle as well. So it's now emerging, and then also because of these programs, there's like a lot of positive motivation to grow, to do more in dairy farming. Like, I'm not sure whether it's going to be, you know, I heard that there will be like more mega farms that will be built in Indonesia responding to this program.
Is dairy a big part of an Indonesian diet?
Actually, not culturally, because of the structural transformation, and then also increasing incomes, number of middle income people as well is growing. That's when the demand for milk, fresh milk, also dairy products is also growing. So actually, for now, the consumption is still 16.2 kilograms per capita, but it's expected to keep growing. And also that's why this free meal nutrition program was one of the aim was to increase the awareness of to drink milk.
I guess in the long term for Indonesia and their dairy sector, do you see like any possibility, like how Australia can help grow that sector there? Like, is there a way that they can build that relationship? Surely it should be more than just us sending dairy cattle over there.
Yeah, true. Yeah, I agree with that. And also I think, again, with Australia, Indonesia, with this already like very strong relationship in different sectors, and I think Australia have the capacity, also have the expertise to help to support Indonesian government, Indonesian government, Indonesian farmers also to improve their capacity on like handling good quality milk, for example, how to take care of animals. I think all of this training are needed.
That is Dr. Rita Aksar from the Centre for Global Food and Resources at the University of Adelaide. He was speaking to Annie Brown. Let's get to the market now. 1,632 head of cattle penned for sale today. That's down 29 head on last week. Terry Birkin's been keeping an eye on the market. How was the yarding today, Terry?
Hi, Belinda. Numbers were virtually the same this week, with 29 less than last week. There were some very good runs of trade weights and fat cows, along with good lines of local yearlings and weaners. Pastoral cattle range from very well presented and finished bodies, as well as big lines of playing calves under 300 kilos, both in the trade sale and the calf sale. Local weaner steers, like in cover, started from 250 cents to 350 cents, and with more fat cover sold up to 460 cents. A lot of weaner heifers range from 198 cents to 278 cents, and better presented heifers reached a top of 404 cents a kilo. Local yearling steers under 330 kg sold from 350 to 430 cents, and heavier weights from 360 to 440 cents a kilo. Yearling heifers under 330 kg were selling from 208 cents to 302 cents, and with more weight and frame sold from 250 cents to 408 cents a kilo. Plain pastoral steer calves started from 180 cents up to 280 cents, and with more frame and cover sold up to a top of 432 cents a kilo. The same story for pastoral heifers, starting from 164 cents to 230 cents for plainer types, and better presented heifers with good fat cover and glossy skins range from 275 cents up to 390 cents a kilo. Local grown steers returned 344 cents to 434 cents, while pastoral grown steers made 246 to 374 cents. And grown heifers collectively sold from 320 cents to 408 cents a kilo. The cow market eased 20 to 25 cents, with store cows selling from 160 cents to 290 cents, while medium weight cows made 218 to 312 cents, and heavy cows sold to a top of 316 cents a kilo. Plain bulls back to paddocks sold from 150 cents to 310 cents, while bulls suited for shipping sold from 210 to 372 cents, and heavy bulls gained 10 to 15 cents, selling from 208 cents to 312 cents, lifting 10 cents a kilo. This is Terry Birkin for MLA's National Livestock Reporting Service.
Thank you so much for that, Terry, and we'll be back at Mouchet this time tomorrow for the results of the sheep market. Talk to you tomorrow. Enjoy your afternoon. News time, 1 o'clock.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.